The News Dissector with Danny Schechter, Thursdays at 10 a.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Sensing a name home,
and that is the voice of the improbable, the impossible, the unbelievable, the unlikely, Siri La Loca, a Broadway star, a musician, and a host on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. She's joining us today on News Dissector Radio. I'm your News Dissector, Danny Schechter, for the next hour, talking about what's not in the news as well as what's in the news, discussing the issues that are often missed or forgotten or buried in our media. I'm happy to be here with you. We have quite a show for you today. Joining us, Mickey Hoff, who's the director of Project Censored, which for many, many years, since 1976, has offered an analysis of the 25 top censored stories in America. Mickey is in the house. Mickey will be talking with us. On top of that, I hope to be bringing in via phone Joan Countryman, civil rights movement activist who I worked with many years ago, to reflect on what she's up to and what we're doing. And then, in the last half hour of this program, we're going to be visiting with the Riham El-Farah Memorial Journalist Fellowship Program. Did I get that right? The Outreach Division of the Department of Public Information at the United Nations. These are journalists that every year come to New York to be at the UN, to see what the UN is about. And guess what? They're here today on News Dissector Radio. We have journalists here from Bosnia, from Russia, from Haiti, from Barbuda and Antigua, from definitely Zambia. Let's see, from Uzbekistan. Let's not leave them out. Let's not leave Zambia out. Let's not leave Bahrain out. And who am I missing? Togo, in the house here on News Dissector Radio. We'll be hearing from all of these people, getting an international perspective of journalists. I'm also going to be joined with by Sherry Welch, the dissectress. Sherry, are you there?
Yes, Danny.
Well, you can't believe this. We have like 20 people in the studio, a great group, and we're going to be hearing from them and from you. Sherry is in Atlanta, Georgia, and she joins me every week. She produces the show and produces a News Dissector blog on MediaChannel.org. So all of that is coming up. But first, ladies and gentlemen, our anthem.
To chase and to walk home via Wells Fargo.
So that's the anthem for my film, In Debt We Trust, and I'll be playing some other music about the economy in this program and about the state of a broken economy that is not only bringing us down, but many people around the world. The danger is real of a new depression. I wouldn't say, you know, we've beaten this. The recovery is really questionable, and we'll be hearing more about that. But first, and I'm very pleased to have in the studio with me today, Mickey Hoff. Mickey works at Sonoma State University in California. He's the new director of Project Censored, and he's involved with Peter Phillips in the new book Censored 2011, published by Seven Stories Press, the top 25 censored stories of the past year, 2009, 2010. Welcome, Mickey. Give us a little summary of what Project Censored is all about and what this book is all about.
Thanks so much for having me here, Danny. It's a pleasure to be here, and a pleasure to be here all week talking to a lot of people about the new Censored 2011 book. Project Censored is a media research group. We've been around since 1976, founded by Carl Jensen at Sonoma State University. Carl ran the Project Censored for 20 years and handed it over to Peter Phillips, a sociologist. I recently became director this year, and I'm actually at Diablo Valley College, which reflects the fact fact that Sonoma State is not the center of the project anymore. We're actually on 36 different campuses,
wow,
almost 40 campuses. We're under the umbrella of Media Freedom Foundation. And what we do, the prime purpose of Project Censored is to try to highlight or give legs to or create a megaphone for underreported or undercovered stories. See, censorship isn't just the story that's never written. It's not just the black hand coming out of the sky and wiping the story out. It's anything that interferes with the free flow of information in a society that purports to have a free press. So we're trying to really boost as much as possible some of the what we think are some of the most important stories, and we validate these stories through students, library research, LexisNexis databases, professors that are experts in the topics, and we put them all on our website at projectcensored.org.
Now, my hunch is that many of the young journalists in the room with us today come from countries, some of which do censor the news, do repress the news. They've grown up in a climate of state domination or state control of information. Their view of censorship is pretty simple. You know, government, the government steps in, the government stops people from hearing about things. The new Nobel Prize winner from China announced today, you know, not covered in the Chinese press. That's their view of censorship. And what you're saying, it seems to me, is that's not the only view of censorship.
Yeah, censorship, it comes in far more insidious guises in societies that purport to be free. In other words, we do have government intrusion in media in this country. I mean, going back long before Operation Mockingbird and the CIA and so forth, but some of the more problematic forms of censorship occur because there's this assumption that we have a free press and that things are reported regularly. However, there are many different ways that information can be slanted or skewed. There's framing, sliding of content. There's a whole host of tactics that can take place that take the guise of reporting actual factual information where you are led to believe you're getting the full story about something, but there's crucial information or historical context that's left out. So censorship is more often a matter of degree in America's commercial media.
Interesting. You know, I think that, I mean, I worked inside America's commercial media, so I experienced it, you know. And here's how it works sometimes. You propose a story. They say, well, I'm not that interested in that. Can you give me a story about Tina Turner? You know, can you do something about an entity? I said, yeah, I love Tina Turner. I'd be happy to. But what about, you know, the SNL crisis? Well, you know, we'll get to that maybe, you know. So this is the problem, like what gets covered and then how it's covered and whether it's covered in a way that really informs people. We have a word in America, which I'm going to share with these students and journalists and fellows from around the world. It's called MEGO, M-E-G-O, and it stands for my eyes glaze over. In other words, you give me too much information, I can't absorb it, I don't understand what you're talking about, and as a result, let's keep it stupid, let's keep it simple, let's dumb it down. And that seems to be the way the American media works, and that's the formula that guides it. You know, true, Mickey, or not?
Yeah, I have to agree with you. I'm sad to have to agree on that count, but you know, Peter and I have been talking for a couple of years now. Yeah, I know you were part of this in 2008. It was what we called the truth emergency sort of movement, that we live in a society where we're awash in a sea of information, but we seem to have a paucity of understanding about what it all means, a lacking of the connecting of the dots. So it isn't necessarily that things aren't even reported, it's just they often lack significant context or important details. We live in a state of hyper-reality where people can't really tell the difference between what's real and what isn't, what's fact and what's fiction. Because we lived in a top-down, corporate-managed news culture where information is really, really siphoned and created, and we're titillized and sort of distracted by a lot of the things that corporate media find to be important, like Tiger Woods or celebrity deaths or these kinds of things, instead of the key things that really affect most people, including, you mentioned, the economy, which is one of our number one stories here.
He sounds like one of those Southern preachers, doesn't he? He's just rattling it off, man. He's just, you know, basically sharing it with us. Sherry, any thoughts?
Yeah, I'm on their website right now, and here's a story that you don't see in the headlines. In the United States, 90% of black children will be fed by food stamps, and we have 38 million Americans now on food stamps.
So this is like a little fact, but this little fact tends to get buried in the bigger facts, and as a result doesn't stand out. You don't really have a sense of the pain, the desperation, the frustration of people who are out of work and people who don't know where their next meal is coming from. I mean, it's one thing to talk about poverty in Africa, and a lot of us have, about, you know, people in Africa living on $2 a day, but they're increasing, or $1 a day. Increasingly, that same thing is happening here, sort of the third worldization of the United States, and it's something that we have to be concerned about. Mickey, what are some of the stories this year that were the top 25 censored stories?
Well, some of the stories this year, I know you'll be really familiar with the first story on global plans to replace the dollar. That was the number one story this year. Russia, Iran, China, several Latin American countries, South American countries are really working to try to find out how to get the dollar out, you know, not have the dollar as a global trade currency, get it off of petrodollars, this kind of a thing, because the United States keeps raising their debt ceiling, and we use this, of course, to fuel our military industrial complex that's in over 130 countries with 1,000 bases that really controls and intimidates other peoples across the world.
So this is sort of what the Chinese would call a sort of dollar hegemony. We have a Chinese person here today. You know, the idea that when we look at the world, we really often don't look at ourselves and how we might contribute to some of these problems. We tend to look at, them out there. It's their fault. And not to really look at how events tend to influence and affect each other. What about the other stories and the top censored stories of the year?
Story number two is really, I guess it's not shocking for anybody that pays attention or really thinks about it, but the interesting thing is, I mean, we had several people write about this story, Sora Flounders, Mickey Z. It's the U.S. Defense Department is the worst polluter on the planet. The Pentagon uses 80% of the energy of the entire U.S. government. The Pentagon uses 320,000 barrels of oil a day, not counting contractors. The United States military is responsible for depleted uranium, tens of thousands of pounds of microparticles of radioactive, highly toxic waste left in the Middle East, Central Asia, the Balkans. We've left.
See, we got the Balkans in there for you, okay?
Our
journalists from Bosnia.
Yeah, and dioxins in Vietnam, over three decades after we've been there, we still have 400 times higher rates of than is safer for dioxin, and it causes a spate of cancers generations later. We've desertified Iraq, 90% of the land, in fact. We've changed Iraq from a food exporter into a country that now imports 80% of its food. We leave rusting barrels of chemicals and solvents all the world over. We've dropped 60 nuclear bombs on the Marshall Islands.
Are you impressed by the recent announcement by the Defense Department that it wants to go green?
Oh, yeah, just like BP wants to go green. And they all want to have the green PR marketing strategies to try to convince people that they're not horrifically destroying our planet.
So that's the Defense Department. You've taken them out in this particular story. Who else gets the Project Censored treatment?
Well, you know, this year we've got internet privacy and personal access at risk. We're looking at the issues of net neutrality. We're looking at cybersecurity laws in the United States. The government can shut down the internet in the name of national security. We're looking at Blackwater's secret war, now known as Z, secret war in Pakistan. We're looking at healthcare restrictions costing thousands of lives in the U.S.
Wow.
We have a whole section on capitalist forces wreaking havoc in Africa. Of course, this has been going on for two centuries.
I'd like you to turn to number 12.
Sure.
Because we have a Haitian journalist here. Where is he? And you'll find this interesting, okay? Tell him what this is about.
Well, in a nutshell, this story is that Cuba was the prime. They gave the greatest medical aid to Haiti after the earthquake. And, you know, Cuba also,
more than the United States, more than other countries?
Yeah, they were one of the biggest contributors. They were the first and one of the best contributors here. They're really trying to get on it. You know, other Western countries had cruise ships going and having tourists, you know, lounging around on Haitian beaches while people on other sides of the island were. This is incredible. But in the U.S. press, everything Cuba is all bad. And so we can't ever talk about this. Just like how Cuba were one of the first countries to try to offer aid to Katrina victims and we turned them away.
Well, what do you think about this? That a report that Cuba provided the greatest medical aid to Haiti after the earthquake.
And any media didn't talk about. I read them on a website, but on any media, and Haitian traditional media, and U.S. media.
Didn't talk about it.
No.
But it's amazing, and this is really shocking, only 2% of all that money that was raised for Haiti has gotten to Haiti. There are people living in these tent camps in Haiti who are completely at risk of a new storm of being washed out to sea. Already there was one storm and several people died there's been no effort, not only no effort to try to house these people, but the people who were housed after the earthquake, many of them are being evicted by the rich families in Haiti, and they're being removed from what home and habitation they have. I mean, this is really shocking, Sherry. Do you agree? I mean, how do you see this?
hello, Sherry, you have to stay with me. I'm trying to involve you in all this. Hello. We're talking about Haiti and about the aid. I mean, we were talking about this when all this was going on, all those telethons and all those artists raising money for Haiti. And now to find out that only 2% of the aid has actually gotten there.
That is beyond shocking. And that Cuba gave more than the United States? I don't even understand the United States of America anymore. We're number one, being the worst terrorist on the planet.
You know, one of the journalists here just passed me a note saying it's not a surprise because Cuba provides more medical assistance to the Caribbean countries than anyone else. And in Cuba, I know that the Cuban doctors in Haiti have been very popular because they've been the only doctors in many cases. I mean, it's Dr. Paul Farmer. There are some people who have been working there. But you have like 1,000 NGOs in Haiti not coordinating with each other, not working together. And as a consequence, the services that are being provided to the Haitian people, is really a crime.
It's shock and awe writ large.
Now let's go on with some more stories here from your book.
We also covered, of course, the U.S. Still funding and supporting the Taliban. This is really an old pattern.
The U.S.
story.
Supporting the Taliban? I thought we were against the Taliban.
Yeah, of course. Just like we were, against Iran when we were funding simultaneously funding Saddam Hussein and the Iranians during the '80s war there. This is a pattern in American history. And the munitions industries and the bankers, you fund both sides, and everybody, they all win, no matter what the price is paid by the people on the ground. The banks win, and the U.S. Taliban, I mean, again, and these people that talk about supporting the troops and with all the bumper stickers and this kind of thing, take a look at the depleted uranium and all the things that are putting American troops in harm's way, not to mention the people in these other countries. But this is the same kind of thing as how we're funding the people that we're allegedly fighting in public.
Well,
it compounds problems.
This is kind of mind-blowing, and it is important, because, again, we had a little debate before this program began, and I mentioned that I was interviewed on Press TV and Russia Today, mm-hmm. and I was saying, those are propaganda channels. Can we consider some of the American media to be propaganda channels?
They're all propaganda channels, and that includes National Propaganda Radio, or National Pentagon Radio, as it's sometimes called, or a propaganda broadcasting system, the top-down kind of how it's meant to be, sort of like, well, we include things. We're more inclusive on these channels. But these are real problems, and the corporate media in this country is not in the business of news. They're in the business of infotainment and distraction. It's top-down managed news propaganda to brainwash the American public and prevent people from thinking critically and coming to their own conclusions on the basis of transparently sourced facts.
Well, let me just basically thank you, Mickey, for coming in. I know we just had 20 minutes. There was a lot more that could be said and will be said, but I wanted to call attention to the work of Project Censor, to Censor 2011, this new book published by Seven Stories Press on media democracy in action. I think it's very important, particularly for journalists from other countries, to become aware of the critical counter-narrative that emerges in the United States from a lot of journalists. Most people tend to think, like, the New York Times, that's it. Washington Post, that's it. The networks, that's it. But there's a whole healthy, robust, if underfunded, independent media in America, and they offer perspectives from around the world that really are important. They try to support the aspirations of people in other countries. I mean, people from Southern Africa know well the anti-apartheid movement here was a big help in helping to free South Africa. And I think we see at times in our history when Americans become more international and more engaged in the world. Unfortunately, largely because of our media, they're often not. And I would just call attention, anybody listening, my News Dissector blog, newsdissector.com/blog, on mediachannel.org this week. And I feature in it an interview I gave with RT, an interview that was done with me on Press TV on their autograph show. So they're interviewing me. What does Iran want to know from your News Dissector? Go online and find out. Also, I was just on Grit TV, and I was on Democracy Now! Earlier in the week. So I'm trying as best I can to report on all this. Hold on 1 second. A phone call coming in. Hello, I guess not. Do we have our next guest? No, it's going now.
I'd like to take the opportunity just to thank you, Danny, for having me here for Project Censored, and it's an honor to be in the room with journalists from all over the world. So much appreciation. Keep up the good work.
Well, you know, thank you very much. And, folks, I really suggest that you get hold of this Project Censored. Can we ask him to come in here? Can we ask him to come in here? Come in here. And let's give him this number. There's a 401 number there, if you could call that. That's our next guest. Can you take that?
Okay. 413.
Yeah. Okay, guys. Thank you, Mickey. Folks, we're going to hear from all these journalists from the UN in a few minutes. And Sidi, talk to me a quick moment about your program and what you're doing.
Actually, it's quite interesting. I'm just being in context here because I'm working on the show called To the Rising Sun, the music of three phenomenal, courageous women whose voices as artists were also voices that really spoke to their cause as activists, as human rights activists, and people who really stood for something special. Miriam Makeba from South Africa, Nina Simone from the United States, and Odetta also from the United States. And I'm thrilled to say that it's a show that I'd really like to see go around the world to excite us again, if there's such a word, and galvanize us with a new spirit.
So this is the voice of culture, the voice of great musicians and women singers, and this is something that we want to encourage. And CD, what time will your show be on Progressive Radio Network?
It's next week, actually. I'll be interviewing one of the writers of the show. And
what time?
At 7 p.m. till 8 p.m. on Tuesday, October. So it'll be on Tuesdays, but our first.
Okay, very good. So, Sidi, hold that thought for a moment. We'll be coming back to you. I'm trying to do a lot of business here. Sherry, are you still there?
Yes.
Okay. All right, Sherry. So now we're swinging over to A Blast from the Past, and we're swinging over to Great Barrington, Massachusetts, where an old friend of mine, Joan Countryman, is standing by. Joan was one of the organizers of the Northern Student Movement with her husband, late Peter Countryman, and that was part of the civil rights movement that didn't get a lot of news and attention, but there were efforts, organizing efforts, in many cities across America. I work with the Northern Student Movement in Harlem. I worked in Baltimore. This was in the 60s. Joan, welcome.
Thank you, Daddy.
I know Frank was supposed to be one of our other NSM colleagues was supposed to be on, so we're going to do this again properly. Unfortunately, I don't have that much time today because I have journalists here from all over the world as part of a UN program visiting in the studio, and you know they just agreed to be on, so I didn't want to miss them.
Sure.
So, Joan, just tell people a little bit about what you've been doing, what you did in the civil rights movement, what you've been doing since.
Well, since is a long time, Danny.
Right.
I was involved in the civil rights movement from in the early 60s when I was in college, like anybody else who was in college in 1960 and paying attention. I was inspired by the sit-in movement that started in Greensboro, North Carolina in February 1960, and that certainly made those of us at Sarah Lawrence think that we ought to do something. So beginning with protests at Woolworths and moving on to setting up what we called the Northern Student Movement, which was a way for students, particularly in colleges in the North, to support the Southern students and then to begin to work in our own communities. And as you know, we started, among other things, tutoring projects in high schools in pretty much all over the Eastern Seaboard, actually in Chicago and Detroit as well, that were designed to get more students from black and poor communities to think about going to college.
So, you know, why this is significant is, in my mind, is that it's a form of service. It's a form of people actually not just denouncing, you know, bad education, but actually getting engaged in education
exactly.
And helping people on a one-on-one basis.
Yeah, now, I think it happened in two ways, too. I think we were helping students. We were also learning a lot ourselves about how the country was structured, what was wrong with public education, and how we could make a difference.
I think this is important now because, you know, right now there's a new movie out Waiting for Superman about education, basically saying the charter schools are the way to go, denouncing, mm-hmm. you know, teachers, unionized teachers particularly, it's not caring, not really working on behalf of kids. And, you know, here's a situation where the community could get involved in schools and help children. You know,
and exactly that's it's happening in the best areas. That is what's happening, is that the community is involved.
Actually, there is an organization called Communities in Schools that was founded by Bill Milliken, where they mentor. Actually, he's a local of Atlanta, but now he's in Virginia. Mm-hmm. But where they mentor children to stay in high school, and Elaine Wynn of Steve Wynn Las Vegas fame is their chairman of the board, and they do wonderful work.
Mm-hmm. Well, another example is the Algebra Project, which Bob Moses started. Bob is very involved in the Southern student movement, and one of the things that they have done is get young people involved. The Young People's Project, which does community work around schools, around getting kids more interested in math, which is one of my I was a math teacher for many years. That's one of my great interests.
2 + 2 =
five Joan, sometimes.
Exactly. You know, Joan, you know, your reflections. We've just had another March on Washington. It's a long time since Dr. King gave his I Have a Dream speech. The civil rights movement is sort of long gone. On the other hand, it sort of lives on in a way. And I think a lot of things would not be happening today if there wasn't a civil rights movement.
Absolutely. That movement inspired so many things. And one of the, you know, my son is an historian. I'm just as nostalgic as the next person, but I also don't believe that we should just sit and look back. However, I think one of the things that excites me about the celebration of the 50th anniversary of SNCC or soon to 50th anniversary of Northern Student Movement is that it reminds us that, first of all, the inspiration of those young people, and secondly, that the work isn't done and that we can do something. What the student movement said to me was that ordinary people can do extraordinary things. And, you know, I keep saying to my students and grandchildren, I voted for the president not because I thought he was going to solve the problems, but that he believed that the rest of us would make significant contributions to solve these problems.
Yeah, well, I'll just say, you know, Joan, that you were one of the inspirational leaders that got me involved in the civil rights movement.
Well, thank you, Danny. And, you're inspiring too, you know.
Thank you. But, you know, rather than a love fest, I mean, this was a woman who spoke from her heart, who spoke so clearly and eloquently and touched the lives of a lot of people. You know, I believe that your contribution really needs to be honored. Apparently there was a panel in North Carolina on the Northern Student Movement. How did that go?
That went very well. I actually missed that one, but I know it went well because by the time I got to the conference, everybody was talking about the need for a history of the Northern Student Movement. Let me just say one other thing, Danny. We had a forum in our public radio station in Rhode Island the other night, and one of the panelists was Richard Rothstein, and he and I had not seen each other in 50 years. He was education person at the Times for many years, but he was involved in the Northern Student Movement, and when I looked at him, I thought, isn't that funny? That looks like Richard Rothstein, and then it was. And he says that, you know, he got started because of the work of NSM.
Well, you know, the lesson here, you know, to the young journalists who are here today in the studio with me from Haiti, from China, from Bosnia, from Bahrain, from Zambia, from Russia, from Uzbekistan, from many other countries, seems to me that one of the ways you become a better journalist is that you have experience in the world.
Absolutely.
You actually work with people. You actually hear their concerns. You actually get engaged in something, because that will inform your journalism. I think I'm a better journalist today because of having been part of the civil rights movement, not just because I met Dr. King and Joan Countryman and Malcolm X and other great leaders, but because I was involved. I actually, you know, played a role in something bigger than myself.
And so it was more real for you, yeah?
Yeah, and I think that being part of it, it also gives you a different narrative. You know, you understand to ask questions like, who's benefiting from this policy? Mm-hmm. Who is being helped by this? And who is being hurt by this? And what about ordinary people? And what about their lives? You know, this is, to me, you know, the key issues that journalists forget. We do get caught up in serving power and being around all these politicians and trying to quote them and interview them and et cetera and so forth. And we miss what's happening at the bottom. You know, it's not the ship that makes the waves. It's the motion on the ocean. I learned that lesson many years ago. And that's what we have to recognize. And Joan, thank you very much for coming on briefly. I'd like to invite you back when I get Frank and some, maybe Bill Strickland and some of the other Northern Student Movement people on to talk about these issues. But
I still look forward to it.
You are great, and keep
Joan,
on.
Joan, do you have a website where we could learn more about you?
I don't have a website. I think we're going to set up an NSM website, but if you Google me, you'll find out all sorts of things.
There you go. Joan Countryman, thank you for being with us. We'll be back in a minute.
We know that your life is hard, so please put down your guard. We'll send you a gift to give you a lift, a shiny new credit card. Don't fret if your funds are low, you can use it wherever you go. Whenever you do, your debts will accrue and give us a happy glow.
It's so fantastic.
When you pay with Blaster.
This is PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
Hello. Check out my show, The Animal Magnet Pet Radio, live every Tuesday at 1 p.m. Eastern on Progressive Radio Network. Or catch it anytime you like by scrolling through the archives. You'll hear me, Deborah Wolf, best-selling author and award-winning radio host, chatting with the best pet experts and animal A-listers in the world about controversial topics like breed bans, the indoor versus outdoor cat debate, and whatever else is hot in the news and on their minds that matters to animals and the people who love them. Plus, we tell pet jokes, we'll give you trivia and smart, quirky facts, recipes, and take-home tricks and tests, homework your pets will love. Email your pet problems to me and we'll solve them on air. So listen to The Animal Magnet on Progressive Radio Network and get your animal fix.
The shaky economy, peak oil, and now an unstable climate. Get the inside story with Alex Smith on Radio EcoShock. Top scientists find a looming catastrophe while activists try for change. Experts, authors, and alternative media from around the world and around the corner. Hear it all. Radio EcoShock every Saturday afternoon at 2 o'clock. Listen free and live free right here on PRN, ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
Progressives, this is Betsy Rosenberg on the Green Front. I hope you've been enjoying the news I'm bringing you hot off the press, so to speak, like behind-the-scenes stories and insider scoop from Al Gore's recent climate conference. I know the Greenistas and love introducing the most informative and inspiring experts on the Green Front every week. So join me as we learn more about our environment and what we can do to turn it around.
The Green Front with Betsy Rosenberg, every Wednesday at 2 on the Progressive Radio Network.
You're listening to the Progressive Radio Network, your number one source for progressive commentary.
Advisory side of my business. I knew what I was doing was wrong, indeed criminal.
The shine on America's shoes got gold.
When Wall Street stepped into the fold,
Congress paid off workers, laid off.
Oxford, AIG, and Maydon. Credit swaps, credit stops, empty wallets, and empty shops. Then Bangkok and the AAA, Grandpa loses 401k.
Plunder, plunder, plunder. That's the my new film, Plunder, the Crime of Our Time. You can find out more about it at plunderthecrimeofourtime.com. Order a copy or read about the background to that in my book, The Crime of Our Time, which is about the financial crisis as a crime story. Now, for the last, we've saved the best. We have journalists here from many parts of the world taking part in this program with us. So we're going to ask them, some of them, to introduce themselves and give them their reactions on how we're doing so far. Our first journalist comes from Russia. Introduce yourself.
Yeah, hello, everybody. My name is Yuri Bakhnov, and I come from Moscow, Russia, and I work for television back home.
That was almost
and what do you think? What do you think of the show so far?
Well, I love it. It's great. We have very interesting people from around the globe. The host is very, very professional and a very nice guy, actually. Yeah. Well, although we do not agree on some topics.
Yeah, of course. That's only because you're not well informed about them. I'm kidding. Our friend from Mozambique is next. La luta continua. It means the struggle continues. Talk to me.
Thank you for inviting me to this opportunity to talk to your radio and your program. I'm really kind of I feel grateful to be here. Yeah, my name is Milton Michel. Yeah.
Milton Michel. Michel, that sounds like a name I've heard before. What is that name in Mozambique? Is that any relationship to the late President Samora Machel?
Yeah, I have sort of a relationship with him because my grandfather was his direct cousin. You know, they were cousins, so at some point we are a family.
So that's an extended family, Africa style, and I'm very happy to have you here. I was in Mozambique, by the way, and I met President Samora Machel when I was there with Jesse Jackson in 1986. And we saw him off. He got on a plane to go to a conference, and then unfortunately he never returned because the plane was either shot down or in some ways crashed in Mozambique. We still don't know all the facts about it, but it was a terrible loss for Africa. Many of the leaders of Frelimo, the movement, were on the plane, African revolutionary leaders of various kinds, and it was a really terrible blow. For that country. His wife, Gracia Machel, is now married to Nelson Mandela, but she was one of the great leaders of Mozambique as well. So I'm thrilled to have you here. That's really cool. What do you think of what we've been talking about censorship in America and the like?
It was really interesting. You know, we in Africa or in Mozambique, normally we don't get a sense of this kind of thing happening in US, you know, censorship. We tend to think that, yeah, there's a freedom of press, freedom of expression, a free press and a powerful press actually, and also some sort of propaganda press which is kind of driven by the corporate interests who are behind the media that at some point exercise some sort of propaganda. So to hear that you have this kind of censorship here in US, it opens our minds on really how is the media specter in U.S. and even in the world, if we can say that.
Well, we can't say that because, you know, international media, Associated Press, is in countries all over the world. The American media footprint, the American media style is in places around the world. I used to work at CNN, and CNN created a program called World Report. And the idea of World Report was journalists from other countries could contribute a story every week, and they wouldn't get paid, but that story would go on the World Report. It was a great idea to democratize CNN, internationalize CNN. Then they had, you know, a training session in Atlanta, and journalists went there to learn from CNN. At the end of it,
The idea of doing it in the first place was, let's make CNN more diverse. Let's make other voices on CNN. But a lot of the people who went there were influenced to become like CNN. They got, you know, the suits, the look, the language, the culture, and they, you know, they were imitating CNN. They were trying. They figured this is real journalism. What we do isn't. And the consequence was that it was more homogenized. It was more one thing than it was different. And many of the journalists who went there later, you know, some of them told me, you know, that we really made a mistake. We didn't take advantage of this opportunity to really express our feelings. They wanted to be polite. They didn't want to, like, really offer criticisms. Like, some of the people here have criticized me earlier, you know, for being on press TV. You know, somehow I'm a propagandist for Iran. And, you know, that's okay. I like this kind of debate. Now, our next guest here is from Bosnia. Talk to me about what's happening in Bosnia and about you.
Well, my name is Andrea Vuković and I come from Banja Luka. I had to add something to the previous conversation about American media and propaganda. I have to tell you that ever since by the time that we actually got here to this show, I thought that all American media are propaganda-like. I'm kidding about that, but seriously, we have in Bosnia, most of the journalists have this opinion that American medias are all about propaganda, that you can really feel and hear voices of independent media outlets and journalists and freelancers and everything like that. So we would basically say, I can say that I found you a very free, so to say, when we got here.
Well, I'm not getting paid, so that may be one reason. but you know, I thank you for that. I mean, I try to be. You know, part of it is having worked in all kinds of different media, in the mainstream media, in independent media. So I've had some experience in the media system. You know, CD, just like you, have had experience in the mainstream Broadway, for example. And yet, it hasn't really changed your orientation to want to celebrate the women musicians and singers who have really been voices of freedom.
And it's actually all connected. I mean, how could we say that the culture is disconnected from the reality of a whole world? So really, it's just simply, I think, the important awareness that artists are human beings. Everyone else is a human being, and we are conscious people. We're people of heart, of compassion, and also we're involved in whatever that affects our lives. We care. So it's important that people, as they even look at, I think, even American media, and they look at artists from that viewpoint, not to make assumptions. You're hearing the artist's voice as an artist, but you're not necessarily hearing the whole story until such time you give yourself a chance to really hear the heart and the you know, beyond the art. And so,
the heart behind, beyond the beyond art. The,
yes.
I love you, yeah. CD. You're like so articulate. Right.
Thank you.
It's true, you know. But let's just ask you a question. I mean, just as a news person, what is happening in Bosnia? Do you think that the country's going to separate? You know, is there going to be any type of unity there, or is that impossible?
Well, for now, it's really impossible. And actually, on the other hand, I don't think it's going to separate, but at least not for 10 or 20 years, because it's probably an international community and all the big guys in the world won't let it happen. But what happens in Bosnia in terms of media and people who cover those stories is that we don't really push that much, as, for example, you do on this show, which is kind of sad because I try to make my colleagues from other media outlets bring to this movement of pushing them and trying to tell more truth than we have there, but it's just not working.
I mean, to ask challenging questions, to, you know, I think people like honesty. I think people respect people who say what they really feel, whether or not you agree or not. You at least you're getting the, you know, opportunity to hear somebody's actual voice, somebody's actual caring. I mean, Zambia, for example. I mean, you've had a situation in Zambia where you had sort of an authoritarian leader, then you had a kind of corrupt leader. What's happening there now?
Well, thank you for hosting me and us as a team. My name is Rhoda Mfango. I work for Radio Phoenix in Zambia. You have put it right here. At first we had authoritarian. Now we are in a democratic state, but it's democratic to some extent. To some other extent, there's still this regime where they want to control everything. And when I talk about controlling everything, what comes most is information. Because the country cannot develop, I cannot know my rights if I do not have information, and government is trying by all means to curtail the amount of information that is going out. And this is a debate right now. We want them to give us a bill to be enshrined in the Constitution that any person should have access to information. And the government, all they did was to come up with a bill but remove the article which says you are entitled as a citizen to access any kind of information.
So it just shows you how people in power are frightened, actually. Even though they seem to be so strong, they seem to be on top, they're actually totally defensive and totally frightened of any other voice. And so you have a situation where the concerns of ordinary people are not being heard often. I mean, we're in a terrible economic world, global crisis. This is not something, look at what happened in Mozambique just, a few weeks ago. There was a riot of people. Tell me about that. What was happening there with the food?
You know, in Mozambique, normally we have a situation that the government, sometimes they try or they tend to control, the situation in the country with regards to cost of living. But there are some times that even the measures, the plans, the programs the government is putting on are not really working well for the good of the people. So what really happened? It was kind of an eruption of a volcano. People were really, kind of, if I can use the word, fed up of the situation that the cost of living was getting high in many terms, in the cost of the price of bread, cost of energy, cost of water, this social the social services that people must have at some point guaranteed, and then it was a situation where everything was upping in terms of the pricing almost at the same time, and people could not afford, ordinary people could not afford to, this situation. So it was an eruption of kind of volcano.
See, yeah. Many Americans don't really understand how things that happen here affect things that happen in other places. For example, if you have all these investors investing in commodities, this drives up the prices of basic commodities. So somebody in Mozambique is coping with the situation that some rich guy in New York has actually precipitated. He's oblivious to the consequences. He doesn't really know the impact it's having on people around the world. And I think that this is something we have to realize. We're living in a world, in a world where there's a lot of interconnection. There's a lot of linkage between things that are happening. You can't just say this is happening in this country and it's totally not affected by what's happening in other countries. It is affected. And this is why I believe we need to find ways to explain these issues to people, to understand what it means to have a global crisis, because you can't solve this problem if there aren't some global standards and rules. In Europe, in Basel, and they're trying to get rules on the banks, to restrict the banks, but the banks in America, and because of all the money that's gone into American politics, they don't want these tough rules and regulations. As a result, we're in a situation where we very easily could have another major crisis. The people don't know that in the Depression, we had a Depression in 1932. In 1937, we had a second Depression. that happened, a collapse of the economy. Everybody thought, well, we've solved that problem, let's move on. But we didn't solve that problem, and we haven't solved this problem. And this is why I've been writing about this in my blog. I'm trying to talk about this. I want to try to, and I feel like there's this level of unreality going on. It's like, how do you put it? It's like denial. You know, they say the Nile is not just a river in Egypt, you know. Denial is all over the world. And these politicians, they don't want to talk about this. You know, the United Nations, you know, we're talking about 200 million people around the world who are facing higher prices on basic commodities. 200 million who are living on $2 a day, maybe living on $1 a day. This is a massive a crime against the poorest, the most vulnerable people in the world. And who's talking about it? Is it on the news? Do you turn on and do you hear anything about this? No. If there's a flood, you hear about it in Pakistan. If there's Katrina, you hear about it in America, Haiti, an earthquake, you hear about it. But what's actually happening there now? It's in many ways worse for people, because at least then there was hope. There was a sense people are helping, they're trying to help. But now we realize that they're not helping, that the world is turning its back on these people in Pakistan. Why? Because they're Muslim or something. You know, I mean, this is the most religious prejudice, terrible, okay, that we're confronting in our own country. Islamophobia, we call it. It's hideous. And who's speaking out about it? You know, it's very few people. So we need to talk about these issues, and the UN needs to talk about these issues. You know, the UN was set up by the peoples of the world, not the governments of the world. Governments took over the UN. The peoples got pushed out, okay, of the UN. And we need, you know, another chamber in the UN, a people's chamber, you know, for the NGO organizations and everything else. So I'm here preaching this more internationalist message. I don't know who supports me, who doesn't. But, you know, it sounds almost unrealistic when everything seems to be moving in the other direction. But I believe that in the former Yugoslavia, people lived together. It wasn't a great, under Tito, it wasn't great. It wasn't, but they lived together, pretty much got along with each other. And then forces began to manipulate, using nationalist slogans, using appeals to prejudice, using fear as a weapon. And suddenly people were at each other's throats. Look at what happened in Mozambique, the RENAMO. The RENAMO, you know, basically had children killing their parents in the name of something, or we don't even know what, okay? So this is something that I think we have to be aware of. We have to speak about in the media. Sherry, final thoughts?
I'm very impressed with all of their command of the English language. And that I know that they, each of them speaks at least two. And you've done a wonderful job to draw the spotlight on what the United States does and the impact it has globally.
Now, this is from a Southern Belle, ladies and gentlemen.
Oh, please.
A woman in the South who's been helping me, Sherry Welch, and she's done a great job. I really appreciate your being on with me. I like to have a program not just with dominated by men. I like to hear the voices of women. I like to hear voices from around the world as well. And, you know, again, if you go to progressiveradionetwork.com, you can download, go to the archives, you can download these programs, and this program, it'll be up later today. You can go to my blog, mediachannel.org, newsdissector.com/blog, and you can read and see the links to various shows, including the famous, infamous Press TV interview, okay, with this, you know, Islamic woman interviewing me, challenging me. Please, here we have a guest from Bahrain in the Middle East. I'm happy to have you here.
I just want to add something, which I feel sad for it. It was not fair. In Middle East, it was, I can't say it was covered correctly in some aspects. But for those who invaded Iraq for the sake of democracy, is democracy preventing children from going to schools? Is democracy killing people, thousands of people every day. Is that what they wanted? Is that what they wanted to achieve? And thanks for hosting me. Thank you.
Yeah, Operation Iraqi Freedom. 1 million Iraqis dead. Okay.
How about 5 million displaced?
And displaced in other countries, living in Jordan, living in Syria, trying to live in the rest of the world. Nobody focusing on their needs, on their attention. So we're going to be ending up right now. I mean, this has been great. Please write to me at dissector@mediachannel.org if you have any thoughts or comments about how we can make this program better. It'll be on a podcast. You'll be able to share it with your friends. Sidi LaLoca is going to be on the air here on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. What is your program?
It's CD's Grace Notes on Tuesdays, 7 to 8 p.m.
CD's Grace Notes. Don't miss that. CD, you can give us a little final song here from you, if you wouldn't mind. How about Senzenina? Can you do that?
Senzenina, 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 oh, Senzenina, 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 Senzenina.
That means, why are they treating us this way? Beautiful. Sidi LaLoca is going to be one of the stars of this network very soon. Your news dissector is hanging on, trying to get an audience here. She'll get one in a flash in a minute, and I'm so happy about that. So, people, thank you for joining me. We're going to go out with one last song here, because the big news in America has been about this foreclosure crisis, foreclosures on people's homes, people being thrown out of their homes by illegal activities by the banks. So, do we have time to hear a little of this? The song is the oldest song in American history. It's called Home, Sweet Home. And it's about people trying to hold on to their homes. It's something we have to think about, because people are being made homeless because of these banks. So please stay here. Don't leave yet. Thank you so much for being here. Thank you, United Nations. Thank you, Olga. Thank you, Nia. Thank you, everyone, for coming. This was so great to have you here.
Some of us come.